You are listening to Badass in Heels, a podcast for everyone who's ever wondered what it's like to be a woman in the FBI. And now your host, retired supervisory special agent, Nancy Aguilar.
Hi, I'm Nancy. Welcome to Badass in Heels. Today, we're going to continue with part two of episode 19. Last week, you heard from Grace Mason from the Department of State and from Ivana Brennan from the Department of Justice introduced to us ECTAP Empower, the International Criminal Investigative Training Assistance Program, engaging multinational police women on equality and rights. Today, you will hear from Lynn Holland and from Vanessa Dubolay.
We're going to hear now from Lynn Holland, who serves as ECTAP's Senior Law Enforcement Advisor for Empower. Over the course of her domestic and international law enforcement career, Lynn has played a critical role in establishing greater inclusion for women in law enforcement. She was chosen as the first female officer from the U.S. to attend specialized training at the Metropolitan Police, New Scotland Yard. Lynn became the first woman to serve on the executive management team for ECTAP for the Haitian National Police Initiative. Her international experience includes leading the Bosnian program to assist women and men victimized by rape as an act of war. She was selected to be on an elite law enforcement entry team in Kosovo, where she served as a human rights investigator assigned to high-profile cases of massacres and torture of adults and children in the Balkans. Lynn was instrumental in creating the post-conflict Kosovo Police Academy. She is recognized as a security sector reform subject matter expert by the United Nations and the United States Institute of Peace. Lynn serves on leadership positions with sections and committees at the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, and the International Association of Directors of Law Enforcement Standards and Training. Lynn earned her master's degree as a Bush Fellow at the George H.W. Bush School of Government and Public Service, Texas A&M University. Lynn, welcome to Badass in Heels.
Nancy, it's quite an honor to be asked to speak today and to be on your podcast. Since I met you in person in Croatia, you've inspired me and you've taken on a lot of new initiatives. And I'm so glad that you're educating people in general about law enforcement and international law enforcement.
Thank you, Lynn. It's an honor to have you here. I am lucky to be able to call you my friend. I had the pleasure of working with you in Croatia, and I made it a point to chat with you to get to know you, as I had heard amazing things about you. Not only do you have quite the resume, but you are an inspiration and quite the trailblazer. So before we start talking about your efforts, I would like for my listeners to get to know the amazing Lynn. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you very much for those kind comments. I was born in Oakland, California, and I spent 8 years of my life there, where my father served as a prison chaplain at San Quentin State Prison in San Francisco. I thought every little kid that visited their dad at their work got frisked. I found out when I went to school that wasn't the truth. But so it was a unique beginning in my life. And I got to hear about my father having to give less rights to people that were received the death penalty. And it really impacted me. And he used to talk about how it wasn't fair. The system wasn't fair. And I think that really inspired me to try to be part of trying to make a difference. But subsequently, my father decided to accept a position as a chaplain in a prison in Huntingdon, Pennsylvania. So I went from one coast of the United States to the other coast of the United States. It's the first time I experienced snow. So it was a culture shock. And I went to a wonderful high school and I played on a basketball team that never lost for our total 4 years. So I had the opportunity to win. And I think that that has inspired me constantly about projects that I'm working on. I know how it feels to win, and I really think that impacted me for the rest of my life. I also had the opportunity of being selected as an exchange student to Switzerland, and which was the beginning of my opportunity to experience other countries. It was really fantastic to get a different global lens. I have three brothers and one sister, and I'm the eldest. None of them were surprised I became a police officer. They said I was always bossy and wanted to be in charge. And additionally, my mother was also a minister and a prison chaplain. So I was a double preacher's kid. And because of my parents were in the same type of career, I had the opportunity to see that positions could be held by both genders. It really set my mindset that I could choose any career that I wanted to, and that being a woman was no issue. And so I'm really glad that I had the opportunity to have parents who were respectful of each other and always showed me that everyone has equal opportunity. I have interests in photography and antique and new cars. I'm fascinated by cars, all kinds. And I must mention that I have two daughters and one son.
Thanks, Lynn. Wow. I didn't know about your family background. And you made a funny comment about the kids being frisked. You just thought that was normal. But yeah, as children, we kind of, see our parents as role models. And then we think everyone lives the same way, right? Or everything happens in the same way. I like your comment about equality. Both your parents had almost the same role. So you didn't think it was impossible to do something. And you played basketball.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah, I'm 6'1", so it was a perfect fit. And at one time I was the tallest in the league, but it also helped me be a police officer because when I said you're under arrest, they said, yes, ma'am.
So let me ask you. So of course your parents, they work in prisons, right? And I'm sure you were exposed to some law enforcement or police officers, but how do you choose that career?
Well, I went to my undergrads in social work, and my original goal was to, I wanted to start a program to help children, put shoes on children. I used to see children at my school that didn't have brand new shoes, and I just thought that was always horrible. And so I had this goal that I was going to do that. My senior year in college, I did an internship in Child Protective Services, and I hated it. I hated the system. I hated all the things that were going on. And so I realized that I probably shouldn't work in Child Protective Services. So there was an opportunity to apply for a probation and parole job. And I knew I had been around inmates. My father used to have what he used to call graduates that visited our home with people that he felt had been rehabilitated, that I was comfortable. And so I applied for in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to be a probation parole officer for the state of Oklahoma. And so in there, you carry a gun and a badge and you're a peace officer. And during that course, I started to work with the Tulsa Police Department very closely. And for about 6 months, I constantly heard from male officers, because there weren't very many female officers at that time, that I did not think like a probation and parole officer, but I thought like a cop. And I thought, what does that mean? And that means putting on a uniform and working shift work. But I continued to hear this so much that I decided to ride with a police officer who had a program that worked with people who lived in a bad part of town and had alcohol problems. And once I got into that patrol car and rode for a shift, I was hooked. I could not believe this job could be so much fun and that you got paid for it. And law enforcement calls what happened to me blue fever. And I got blue fever bad. So I decided to quit my probation and parole officer job. I took a big cut in pay and became an officer. And it was the best decision I ever made in my career.
Phenomenal story. Oh my gosh. From your dad, or you having visitors, that were ex-prisoners that had been rehabilitated. That is, not every child is exposed to that, right? So you had a very unique upbringing. And I do like, well, let me step back a little bit. Yes, about your social work. That is so difficult and challenging, and I would say sad and angering, right? But I do like your story about the policeman telling you your mentality is that of a cop, right? So maybe they didn't really tell you, come join us and be a police officer. You can do it, right? But they were telling you and sending you messages that you could do it and that you could be a great cop.
Yeah.
So you do that for how long before you decide to become a human rights investigator?
Well, that was a journey of, I was blessed to be selected as the officer of the year for the state of Oklahoma, the first woman. And then Texas heard about me. So I was an officer in Oklahoma for 3 years. And then Texas heard about me and they wanted to lure me across the Red River. That's a big joke in Texas. And so the sheriff recruited me because he wanted me to start. I started Crime Stoppers, victim assistance programs, and I was a spokesperson for the police department in Oklahoma. And he wanted me to start the same type of program in Denton County. And so I moved across the Red River and never looked back. My career in Texas was phenomenal. I had the opportunity then when I was in Texas to study at Scotland Yard. And an experience that really was a pinnacle in changing my career and seeing law enforcement from another completely different lens. And so there I was watching NBC Nightly News and I saw Ray Kelly, who was a commissioner from New York City, and he was in Haiti. And that's how I ended up being selected with ISITAP. Then I went to Bosnia. So then what happened was I was working for a contractor and I was helping with the recruiting and the selection of officers going to Bosnia after I came back from Bosnia. And they got the State Department called and said, we want to send 15 police officers to Kosovo. And I went into my boss and I said, we're going to be sending 14 police officers to Kosovo because I want to be one of those 15. And so I ended up being deployed with 76 men and me. Some people tell me I should write a book that's titled that, but the 76 men and me were included in that were 15 officers that I had the privilege of, at that time, I wasn't allowed to lead them. But I had the privilege of selecting all the team. And so they had unique skills. So we deployed into Kosovo. And as things, we were military observers. I learned to recognize tanks. And I learned to recognize battle. And I was embedded with the Marines. And then Organization of Security and Cooperation ended up taking over the mission. And they were interviewing for human rights investigators. And I had experience interviewing suspects and victims in the United States because I ran the Crime Stopper program and the victim assistance programs at two law enforcement agencies. So I interviewed for the position and was selected. And then what happened is Ambassador Walker, who was the head of the mission, was reading my reports and he liked what I was writing. And he said, I'm going to assign you to the high profile cases. Mm. And that's how that happened. It's all surprises to me.
Wow. You've had a tremendous law enforcement career. No doubt you've done amazing things. And it's like a domino effect. The way you've talked about things is like things just lined up and kept going and kept going and kept going until, I mean, and people are recognizing your work as throughout all these years. And that's why you keep getting other assignments and it's just phenomenal. So what year was this by the time you get those high profile cases assigned?
Yeah, that was in 1998. And that was when ethnic cleansing was in full swing in Kosovo. And so it was quite an experience to be living in a country where Milosevic was still in control. And so I was living there had not taken over. It wasn't a full peacekeeping mission. It was a monitoring mission.
and that phase in your life was probably, I mean, really difficult as a cop or as a police woman. You probably saw a lot of difficult things, but working these type of cases where most of us ladies sitting here probably can't even imagine, right? The levels of torture and horrendous things that you saw, but you weren't relentless. You even risked your life at one point. You know, we were talking back in Croatia about some of these stories, and I was just amazed of how strong you are and how you put others before you, even your own life. So without going into detail, can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, what was it like to be investigating those type of cases?
Well, as a human rights investigator, it was paramount that I remained neutral and that each case was handled equally regardless of the victim's ethnicity. And I had to watch everything I did to make sure that I never appeared to be biased in any of my investigations. I led a very quiet life because I did not go out and have coffee with anybody. I didn't want to be seen with informants. So I did my work. And then I went home. So I didn't get to do a lot of socializing, but that's what I knew I had to do. And I made a conscientious decision to handle each case equally and knew that I needed to document and handle all the evidence correctly. I even at one time had to sleep with my evidence. That was very grueling because we couldn't figure out how to get it out of the country. And finally, we did a diplomatic pouch and we were able to get the information to The Hague. Both of the Albanians and Serbians were not happy with me as I documented these atrocities. And there were a couple of attempts on my life, but God protected me. And I knew because I lived through it that I still had a purpose. It was not easy working on torture, kidnappings, and massacre cases. I believe I've seen crime in a different level that I will call evil. But it was very rewarding for my efforts because they paid off. And I'm very proud to tell you that many of my victim statements and evidence did make it to The Hague and, or part of the indictment on Slobodan Milosevic. I've been blessed to have people tell me that they really felt like I saved their lives. That's why people get into law enforcement. Nothing's better.
Thanks for sharing that with us. It is such a difficult topic to talk about, to hear about. And sometimes although I like to talk, I am at a loss of words sometimes with the things that you say, but I'm sure you made a great impact, like you're just saying, on people's lives. And ultimately, as a police officer, as a law enforcement officer, that's what we sign up to do. And we do the work, like you're saying, you're sleeping with evidence, you do what you need to do. And it's until later that you sit back and you're like, holy, you know, I did this. Yeah. When you're going with it, you just do what you signed up to do. So phenomenal work. Lynn, you're already an ECTAP, right? You're already working for ECTAP, but not necessarily Empower. So how do you make the shift?
Well, what happened was I was working with the State Department and ECTAP seconded me to work with starting the academy. And so I didn't really have a choice in that because I'd helped start the Haitian National Police Academy. Because I had that experience, I was volunteered to switch over to ECTAP and to I had the privilege of being on the executive team that created the Kosovo Police Academy. And my role was to create the selection and recruitment process and ensure that there was representation of all ethnicities who lived in Kosovo. It was not an easy task, especially just after the conflict, locating potential applicants, testing them with entrance exams, doing backgrounds, and completing medical and physical tests. But I had the privilege of leading a wonderful team of officers from 14 countries to assist me in that endeavor. And it was the first time that I had an opportunity to have 14 countries' perspectives on solving a problem. And I want you to know I learned that it was a powerful tool for me as a leader. And so I had no problem recruiting, and I also had no problem recruiting women because there were many women who lost their husbands in the conflict and needed a job to support their families. The first class of students, I believe, had 25% of women, and they were highly educated and motivated. And I set up meetings for them with the female staff at the academy to encourage them because they were having a role that was different than the women officers in the former Kosovo police. And we wanted to make sure they would know they would have equal opportunity for positions with the new police service. And I have met some of these women and men from the first class that are still serving with the Kosovo police. And I have to tell you, as a woman, I'm like a proud mother with children that have done well when I meet them.
Oh my goodness, what a tremendous effort. I can't even begin to imagine the complexities of creating an academy in a foreign country. So just wonderful, Lynn. That's definitely a giant step for any country. So you mentioned that you have seen some of those people that were in the first class. Do you keep in touch with them?
Yes, I do. And the Kosovo Police Service this year will be, in September, will be celebrating the 25th year. And their executive leader there has invited me to come and celebrate with them. So that will be very special. And in the third class of the Kosovo Police that I was part of the selection process, there was a woman named Atife, and she became the president of Kosovo. So there is always some surprises that will happen from your work, and that I would encourage people to do their very best if they're interested in international work, because you don't know, you might be training the future president of a country.
Dang, that's outstanding.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very special. And that was one of my many surprises that I've had in my career.
So of course, you know, early on we talked about all the advisors that ECTAP Empower has, and I can see how you're such an asset to this program. Your law enforcement experience domestically, internationally, the creation of the police academy itself, right? And being able to recruit women. And of course, one of them became the president. So how amazing is that?
Like I said, it's full of surprises, you know?
When do you come back to the United States to fully focus on Empower?
I have been with Empower since the inception in 2019. And it's been a privilege to be part of creating the slate and giving a piece of paper and told, hey, what does this look like? And to be able to take my things that have happened in my career and to be able to pass that on to women and men has been quite a privilege. So I'm very, very grateful for the opportunity. I really believe that being part of the Empower team is part of the pinnacle of what my life has been slated to do. I really do. I think that a lot of things that I've experienced, I can pass on and be helpful to new women that are coming along that are the first women to serve in different capacities.
Everybody that's working for you, alongside with you, should consider themselves very fortunate to be able to learn from you and all the decades of experience that you bring. And I know you're also working on a mentoring program. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I believe a mentorship program is critical to the development of each individual's career competencies. And the United Nations defines mentoring as an all and orientated to sustainable relationship that elevate capacities and capabilities and insights and align with specific goals. I believe having a mentor my entire career has been a critical component to developing me as an executive leader and being equipped to lead up to 500 people at a time. And my mentors saw leadership skills in me that I did not see, and they gave me confidence to become an executive leader. So I really believe in mentorship.
Absolutely. So you had mentors. Have you been a mentor throughout your journey?
Yes. Well, it has been a privilege for me to be asked to be a mentor. And I'm currently mentoring a high ranking woman in Kosovo Police, Major Hoti, and I'm mentoring the highest ranking man of color at Scotland Yard. And it is a privilege for me to have that opportunity to pass on to them what other mentors have passed on to me.
Wonderful, Lynn. Huh.
So Lynn, how have you helped, or how do you see mentoring, helping your two mentees?
Well, I've been able to encourage them on difficult problems that they've had and about solutions on what they should do with their career, whether it's getting more training, being exposed to conferences, professional organizations, or things that will bolster them so that they can achieve the goals that they want to in their careers.
Thank you. So for this mentoring program, do you envision it to be, obviously you're doing it virtual now, right? But is there a plan for Empower to do this in person and offer mentorship courses, classes, or how to be a mentor? Why the importance of being a mentor?
Yeah, so the plan currently is that we're going to do, there's three ways of doing it. There's one where we can do it internally, where we can teach an agency to have their own mentors and help them select mentees and mentors. There is external, where we bring in like people from 30 by 30 project or from an association that has members that are from women in federal law enforcement executives, something like that. So that's external, where they come in and assist. And then there's a hybrid where that we could have both, where they could be, country could ask us to use both examples. And so we are working, starting with individuals, and we're very excited about one of the first individuals will be a high court judge who's created the counterterrorism court in Kenya. And she will be mentored by a woman from OPDAT, who is a federal prosecutor. And we have a man in Bosnia who is the head of the counterterrorism unit, and he will be matched up. And he has two career goals. One is to become an instructor in counterterrorism, and the other one is to create a wellness program in his agency. So we do have the individual. Then we're going to start doing brown bag virtual meetings and inviting what we call change agents. And so it will take all different facets for mentoring, because that's how mentoring is. People need different levels.
Oh, wonderful. It sounds phenomenal, Lynn. I truly wish success to this program. Mentorship is essential. A lot of law enforcement agencies here in the United States are also developing programs, or have recently, because it's not something that's been going on for a long time, right? And if it has, it's been an informal thing. You take somebody under your wing and you share your knowledge, your skills, you try to help them achieve their goals, you include them, right? Which has become more inclusive, diverse. So it's got a lot of benefits. And I think as an older person, you've been in your career for a long time, it also helps bring a sense of repurpose, right? I am now passing. I've achieved the highest rank. What do I do now? Well, pass it on. Pass on all that knowledge. Give back so the next generation in your organization can also keep thriving and making the organization better. So it's great.
I know that if just one person just believes in you, just sees that potential, it can catapult you into another dimension in your career, because that's what happened with me. People saw things in me that I didn't see in myself, and I'm eternally grateful. And I had all male mentors because there weren't any women that had gone before me.
Lynn, you have been in law enforcement, and now, of course, you have been with ECTAP, basically acting as a mentor, right? Every time you go out there on the podium, you're spreading your knowledge, you're sharing everything that you know. Why do you continue to do this? I mean, you could be retired, you could be with your grandchildren, enjoying life, taking photographs, going to car shows. So why to continue to do this?
I have been so blessed to have found my calling or my purpose in life. I know people that have never had that opportunity. And to share what I've learned in my career journey is just very important to me. And if anyone had told me as a young patrol officer that my law enforcement career would provide me an opportunity to live in other countries and to influence their national law enforcement agency strategies, I would not have believed them. I was the first to do so many positions that I was selected for and never had another woman to walk alongside of me. It was very lonely at times. So for me to have the opportunity to influence the development of training and mentoring and develop a professional network opportunities for the Empower program, it is a privilege. I want to see other women be offered the capabilities to develop their greatest potential in both leadership and counterterrorism investigation skill sets. Some one unique opportunity can make the biggest difference in their career.
Lynn, you're truly a trailblazer. Thank you for paving the way for the rest of us women in law enforcement. I have heard from other women who were in the FBI in the 80s and the 90s how challenging it was. And of course, we just heard from you about that road being so lonely. At times, you said you were most of the time the only female. So thank you for your service and everything you've done, surely to pave the way for women like me and the other law enforcement women in the world.
I must mention that the director of ICTAP, Greg Decott, has been very supportive of this program and of me personally. And I'm eternally grateful because I have learned a very difficult lesson. That if you don't have the support of the leadership, it doesn't matter how good your idea is. And so to have the right time where the State Department is supporting this program and to have the right audience, that is the key to the success. So I'm grateful. I also must mention the ICTAP, since I've been part of being the first woman executive since Haiti, has always included women in the academies that they've created. It's never been something that I had to push. It was something that was expected. And so I'm very internally grateful for that.
Thanks, Lynn. You will now hear from Vanessa Duboulay. She is a program officer for ICTAP. She works under the Global Programs and Women, Peace and Security Unit. Vanessa helps implement foreign assistance programs that strengthen the capacity of foreign partners to detect, disrupt, and deter terrorist activity. Vanessa has a master's degree in international affairs from the George Washington University, where she concentrated in international law and organizations and in international development. She has held significant roles, such as working as a program associate for the International Association of Women Judges and the executive assistant to the Office of the Assistant Secretary General at the Organization of American States. And she worked in education policy with the Leadership for Educational Equity. Vanessa, I hear you have done phenomenal work in Jordan and Kenya. But before we jump right into it, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hey, Nancy. Yeah, sure. Before I do that, I just thank you so much for hosting me and the team on the program. Really a huge fan. I know my colleagues have talked about it, but also you have a fan over here, a listener. Really excited to be with you. To tell you a little bit about myself, I'm a Venezuelan American, a foreign affairs professional, right? So I'm currently working, like you said, at the Department of Justice at the ICTAP office with the amazing Empower team. I am a graduate of the George Washington University, also from the Elliott School, like Ivana, where I studied international affairs. I particularly focused on the nexus between international security and development, which were issues that really caught my interest from a very young age. You know, in terms of what I do aside from work, I am an avid reader. I enjoy spending my time reading reports, studying issues that I find fascinating, mostly related to security, international security to be quite specific. And aside from that, I think I'm still trying to figure out what my other hobbies and activities are. I lived for about 9 or 10 years in South Florida, in Miami. So I'm not quite sure what people do up north during the winter time, which is why I tend to avoid it. Normally, you know, you would find me outdoors. I actually really enjoy running and just being outside, picking up a book maybe, and just kind of sitting on the grass and just enjoying listening to birds, watching people, playing sports, huge into that. Also really big into Mahdi United Nations. I used to volunteer for Mahdi United Nations Association or organization where I served for multiple years. And my last commitment with them was just serving on the board of directors as a vice president.
Thanks, Vanessa. So let me go a little bit back. Your last name, Dubolet, is that a French name? You're born in Venezuela. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So my last name is indeed French, but I was born and raised in Venezuela, and so were my parents. So it was actually their families who emigrated from Europe after World War II. Venezuela was at the time a really prosperous and developing country in a way. We had a lot of oil, so everyone was moving there. We had a lot of influx from Europe predominantly. So my grandparents on my mom's side were coming from Spain. My dad's side was coming from Italy and France, which is, I guess, where I picked up my last name.
So do you speak any of those languages, French and Spanish?
So I speak Spanish. It's actually my first language. I do speak French. I understand more than what I speak because I can't practice it in DC quite often. And mm-hmm. I also actually speak Italian and understand Italian quite well.
Wow. And I'm sure all those languages help you with the ECTAP program.
More often than not, I find myself in rooms in which people think I am understanding what they're saying. And in reality, context helps a lot, right? There's a lot of words in languages that places that we work with that are derived from either Romance languages or other languages that I am somewhat familiar with. And so just being able to pick up those keywords and put them in context helps me communicate in my current role.
Just like Ivana and I, right, we emigrated from our countries to here. So how old were you when you immigrated to the United States?
Sure. So I was actually 17, just turned 17. I had just graduated from high school. That's when my parents just decided to move right before I went to college.
Oh, okay. So how would you say, I moved to Canada when I was 15, right into high school. So of course, it's a big, massive change and adaptation. I also was like, what do we do with all the snow, right? Like you were mentioning earlier. how was it for you to adapt and assimilate coming from Venezuela?
that's an interesting question, Nancy, because it definitely was tough. You know, I ultimately ended up falling in love with the life my family built in South Florida. We were kind of all starting fresh, discovering new things, picking up, you know, new words, different language, and trying to find our place within the new community we found ourselves in. So it was definitely tough. My mom, you know, had worked very, very hard to be where she was in Venezuela, where she owned development businesses. She was pretty well known in the city. My dad, pretty high ranking official in the Navy, also had his own businesses. They were both doing very well. All of a sudden, they find themselves in a new country. My mom barely spoke English. My brother, poor kid, was 13. Really tough time to actually move to a new place and try to make new friends. Also didn't speak English that much, so it was quite challenging for him. And my dad was traveling back and forth a lot. So he still was managing his business from Venezuela. And he was in and out every month, sometimes like would be gone for like a 3-month stretch. So it was difficult on the family itself. We weren't really together much. For me, it was a complicated transition at first, right? I was 17. I was still of grade school age, if you will. People that were my age were in their last year, in their senior year, in a school that was right in front of my house, but that I couldn't attend and I couldn't enroll in because I had already graduated. So I had very few friends, if any, during that year-long period in which I was in between high school and college. I ended up playing lots of soccer during that year. So I actually played professional soccer back in Venezuela, moved up until the point where I was playing for state and was getting recruited for the national teams. My friends currently play in the national team, which is fascinating because I get to watch them on TV. But for me, the transition shut that door off. So I found myself playing in clubs in Miami and trying to find a space for me there too, because unlike Venezuela, soccer here, I guess, goes from being in high school to your college career, and then you go into professional. For me, that college step wasn't ever there. Mm. So ended up playing clubs. I then transitioned into playing to a university. I was able to enroll in a school. Started off in West Virginia, out of all places. And the funny story there, two days before I'm going to West Virginia, it was, you know, spring semester, as they call it. I was completely unaware, but it was the middle of January. We're packing up and my mom asked me, you know, what's the weather up there? So you can pack accordingly. I checked the weather. It says it's 19 degrees. I'm like, Mom, it's okay. You know, it's 19 degrees. It's definitely doable. I, you know, came to realize the day after that 19 degrees was not Celsius like we were used to. It was actually Fahrenheit. So we ended up buying loads of jackets that weren't even good ones because we didn't know. And I got shipped off to West Virginia with less than adequate clothing. So I was there for one semester, ended up transferring back to Florida, and continued my undergraduate career there, where I, you know, did different things to keep myself kind of busy and involved, start kind of with my new life. I ended up joining a sorority, became vice president and president. I then also served in the student orientation team, and I was an international student ambassador, trying to make international students' life easier and have a better or smoother transition than perhaps I did. And then I also served on the school's orientation staff, pretty much doing the same thing for commuter students, but also international students.
Thank you. Wow. Very interesting. From the soccer, you know, we named our daughter Mia for Mia Hamm. And she's only seven. She just turned seven and she kind of plays soccer, but our goal in our head, like, oh, she's going to be a soccer player. So that's really amazing. Having grown up until I was 15 in Guatemala, you know, soccer was the thing. So, and then I moved to Canada and it was hockey. I'm like, okay, what is this? So it's great to see women play it, because when I grew up in Guatemala, there were not that many, you know, we're talking the 80s. So there were not, actually, I can't even recall seeing one woman play soccer. So it's pretty amazing to hear, you know, that in Venezuela, that was something, and maybe it's changed in Guatemala as well, but that it's great to hear that they're inclusive now. And of course, here in the United States, they have the team, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, and funny that you mentioned the Celsius, because that was so hard for me when I moved here. It was the same thing. I'm like, why? And the same thing with inches and centimeters. I'm like, why is the United States the only country that does this, right?
I now struggle to convert it backwards. So,
well, now you travel everywhere, right?
Nancy, I got to mention that I've been with Vanessa in several countries, and she, like me, when I use basketball, she's used soccer as a way to communicate with both men and women. And I've seen her in the highest levels in Kenya, kicking around a soccer ball that was in the office, or being out and playing with little kids. So it's really wonderful to watch her in action using that skill.
Wonderful. What a way to build rapport, right? You don't even need to speak. So you've mentioned that at a young age, you developed an interest for international relations. How did that come about? Was it because of your move? You mentioned a lot of reading as well. So how do you develop that interest in international relations?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. One that I get asked a lot, actually. You know, I was involved with politics and the international affairs world since I was very young. Almost all male family members that I had either served in the armed forces or had been involved in politics. My grandpa had at some point become the mayor of his city, or the city that we lived in. So I grew up surrounded with those conversations, those kind of dynamics, without really knowing that I was being exposed to it. I think also growing up in Venezuela, a place where we saw a really rapid deterioration of the political system and of civil rights and liberties, also shaped my interest. People assume, you know, that power politics don't really have a place in smaller countries, yet it sort of is the other way around. When decisions are made in those smaller countries, they directly impact the people almost immediately. And so that's sort of what was happening in my life. Mm-hmm. I was very involved in the discourse around the political movements in Venezuela, really kind of studying what was going on in terms of the changing of dynamics, whether it was the currency, the economic system, or it was in the restriction of liberties. It was a conversation that was very prevalent within my circle of friends, within my family. I guess the final push for me really was joining a Model United Nations team when I was about 12. So I was in sixth grade. I had a teacher that was teaching at that point eighth grade that had come to learn that I spoke English somehow. And she pulled me into a classroom and she said, "Hey, I want you to come and listen to this." It's like, okay, I'll go join. I ended up sitting in her class, and it was a class in which kids my age or a little bit older were discussing issues pertinent to international affairs or international security. It immediately caught my interest. She took me in and essentially developed me to be able to have those sort of conversations. So at some point, I was a 14-year-old talking about uranium-235 and the enrichment and nuclear plants, which was fascinating because I hadn't even got into chemistry or physics lessons at that point. So it was a quick study for those. That's really what shaped my interest there. And then from there on, it continued. I became really familiar and involved with the UN, the United Nations system, mm-hmm. and the dynamics at such. So I represented a couple different countries when I was younger and, you know, got invested in that way.
That's so interesting to hear that at such a young age, right? 14, your school, right? You must have gone to private school.
It was one of the only options in Venezuela.
Oh, I see. It's a great benefit because they teach you things that you wouldn't get in public school. Even here in the United States, I'm not familiar with the system. I might, you know, I send my daughter 7, so, but I don't think that's one of the classes they have. And it's a great benefit to be able to be exposed to high-level education, and that it grabbed your interest, right? And you were hooked because when you're doing your last two academic semesters, you go back and you consult, well, now you actually consult for the UN and the Better World Campaign on matters related to the contemporary peace operations and disinformation and informed on language for the Commitment to Peacekeeping Act, which is a mouthful. And what exactly did that mean to be doing an internship with them?
Yeah, so this was actually during my master's degree at the Elliott School. We had the opportunity to do a capstone study or a capstone project. And so I ended up somehow in a room on a random summer with the executive director for the UN Foundation and the Better World Campaign. And we were talking about just the UN system, and he was quite interested in knowing how I knew about it and why I was so interested in it, because it wasn't, according to him, something that a lot of people were interested in. So I told him the story of how I got involved in Model UN, you know, growing up, why I ended up there. And he looked at me and he said, "Vanessa, do you want to work with us?" And I said, "Listen, I can't. I have a job that I love. I am a full-time graduate student. I don't have the time, but I would love to consult for you if I can." And so my school actually facilitated the process of a small team and I conducting like our capstone project with the Better World Campaign, and mm-hmm. through which we jointly decided to study the effects of disinformation on the contemporary peacekeeping missions in Mali, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and the Central African Republic. That was fascinating. It was, let's say, a childhood dream come true. You know, I used to say that I wanted to work for the UN when I was very little. So for me, that was almost full circle. Mm-hmm. I ended up in briefing rooms that I would have never thought I would be in, and talking to people I didn't think I would get to talk to, right? I was talking to folks out on the field in the peacekeeping missions. I was briefing senior officials at the UN and helping State Department and the United Nations DPO, Department of Peace Operations, craft their strategy to counter disinformation in the peacekeeping setting. So it was fascinating, Nancy, honestly.
You said it, right? It was like your dream come to realization. You're 14 years old, back in Venezuela studying this, and then later on in grad school, you get the opportunity to actually work with these folks and get to do something great. So you talked about the disinformation, the effects of the disinformation campaign. So what were your findings? Okay.
Yes. So the findings of the study were essentially that this disinformation strategy from the UN headquarters was crafted in a way that wasn't conducive to actual implementation in country. So it's very similar to what we see in the foreign affairs field, right? Where we have our policy priorities and objectives, but unless we are out in the field, we have to find ways in which our policies and our foreign assistance and our projects actually marry up to produce the best outcomes for the partners. Mm-hmm. So one of the findings from the study was that we needed to actually resource the peacekeeping missions effectively so that they could then engage in a counter-disinformation mandate. Up to date, these missions were asked to either counter or monitor or vaguely track disinformation incidents, but they weren't really given the resources to do so. So the teams in place were oftentimes two folks in a room tracking all reporting from the field in terms of incidents or tracking narratives, right? It's filtering them into a computer system that couldn't produce accurate patterns or trends, but that just kind of recorded the information in a repository. And unless it made it into a final report, it never made it back to the UN headquarters. So there was a lot of inaction. That was one of the key findings there. It was a truly interesting study because it was one in which we were able to actually point out ways in which the UN Department of Peace Operations could partner with civil society and NGOs that are conducting a lot of disinformation work or counter disinformation work to be able to maximize the outputs of the strategy itself.
Look at you. and I'm hoping that by now they have found a solution, maybe use Power BI to generate the data and be able to actually read it and act upon it, right? Because there's no point of collecting data, like you were saying. First of all, having to hunt for it, then collect it, and then it just sits there. So how do you go about... I have one more question. I have an alibi. So you mentioned during your talk with the director, right, about doing coming to work for the UN, you said you had a job you loved, and of course you were a full-time grad student. So what job was that?
I was actually already at EasyTap working on the Empower team. Okay. Yes.
Good move.
It worked out.
Yeah, you kept your job, you got to experience working for the UN, and of course you you graduated, you did your master's. So you're with EasyTap since when?
I started at EasyTap close to 2 years ago now. Forgive me, I have trouble remembering years, but I think it was 2022, the beginning of summer.
How has that journey been for you?
You know, it's been amazing. The amount of opportunities, support that I've received from both Heather, Ivana, from Sugi, from Lynn, so my team, and then from leadership has been quite amazing. I don't think I ever had such supportive supervisors or bosses or such a supportive team that you can actually lean on. So it's really pushed me to become not just a better and more well-rounded professional, but a better person too. I enjoy it. It's an avenue that's given me an opportunity to work on something I'm really passionate about with people I really care for. So I'm happy to be where I'm at and happy that I landed there by just mere luck.
It is so important to be happy with what you do, right? You wake up every day and you do something that you're passionate and happy about, then you'll be more productive and other people will. Well, it's like a contagious thing, right? Like you just mentioned Heather and your other bosses, they're in good spirits, so are you. And then you trickle on versus like, oh, I got to go to work today. You know? And you're doing something wonderful. So you are a program officer. What does that mean? A program officer for EasyTap Empower.
Thanks, Nancy. That is a very, that's a very interesting and important question, right? I think we say we're program officers without quite defining what that means, because it's quite honestly difficult to define. Program officers at EasyTap do a variety of things. Those can be either helping design project proposals or program proposals and helping define with our supervisors and our leadership strategies to advance not just EasyTap's mission forward, but Department of State's mission forward, whether it is from the Bureau of Counterterrorism or INL, the International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Office, or Bureau, sorry, Or it could be we spend some time doing a bit of the financial tracking, right? Monitoring where our funds are going, ensuring that the partners are getting optimal resources and assistance that we can provide through the use of our funds and making maximizing the outputs of the taxpayer dollars, right? Mm-hmm. So I think our job really varies. What's also very unique and fascinating is that we get to engage with partner nations and pushing forward this joint mission, right? And so one of the things that I truly enjoy about my role as a program officer is that I get to travel to different countries and engage with law enforcement officers in different countries to advance priorities that are jointly held by the foreign partner and by the United States. A perk for me is that I get to work in this women, peace and security environment, which is definitely a passion of mine. So that might look like, you know, holding different meetings with sitting and strategizing with a foreign partner and drafting up a plan that will help us both achieve our collective goals.
Vanessa, you have such an important role for such a significant mission and the benefits. You know, I know working CT matters is not easy and at times could be frustrating and of course stressful because it's very fluid and dynamic. But you get to travel, you get to meet amazing people that have similar mentalities and also want to make this place, to make the world safer, right? And leave a better world for women.
I know you are in Jordan now, as we are recording. So what takes you to Jordan?
What takes me to Jordan is one of our bilateral projects that Grace was describing that stemmed from the broader Empower program. So Jordan sort of just happened, right? We received a call in the summer of 2022 asking us for assistance in setting up a new unit within the Public Security Directorate. Now, that unit was meant to be called the gender branch or gender unit, which was directly tied to our women, peace, and security efforts. So, you know, we engaged in the conversations and we were trying to figure out what this new unit that we were assisting to build was going to do. To give you a bit of context, the gender branch was to sit under Jordan's intelligence and counterterrorism branch within the police service. So it was in a way a perfect opportunity, right? We had willing partners that were ready to engage and work with us, and we had supportive funders on our end from CT. Jordan was, I think, the perfect opportunity to explore what the Empower program could do and what it meant to advance women in the counterterrorism law enforcement on a predominantly Muslim context, which we hadn't had a chance to do before. So that's how we ended up here.
Thanks, Vanessa. So can you tell me how setting up this branch, this gender branch, and being there for the WPS efforts has changed the Jordanian police department?
Yeah, I think that's a really tough question to answer because I don't think that when we engage with our foreign partners, we engage to change the way they do things, right? We engage with them to walk together on a journey that allows us to achieve our collective mission. In this case, to enable or broaden opportunities for women to actually contribute more meaningfully to peace and security objectives. In this case, to the security objectives on the counterterrorism field itself. So to give you a couple of examples here in Jordan, right, aside from helping set up this gender branch and actually focusing on the organizational strengthening component of it, via which we were able to build the branch itself from hiring folks, sitting with them and drafting, you know, terms of reference or job descriptions, sitting with them and consulting on basically what the capacity of the unit was to be and what their mandates or roles were to be so that we could align both. We've also worked with different units within the special branch, the counterterrorism and intelligence division, right? So we've been able to increase the staffing of women into roles into that special branch. This past year, the special branch saw an increase of 35 women that joined to fill more operational roles, whether it was in their intelligence division or in their surveillance teams, which was a really important milestone for them. We also have opened opportunities for our partners to present to large international audiences and to engage in different types of training on policy development, policy management, all with a gender mainstreaming component or gender sensitization component. One of the highlights I wanted to bring up there, Nancy, is that in those international conferences, we actually had the opportunity to see a female officer get nominated to present. It happened twice, right? Two different conferences, female officers actually empowered to talk about their experiences, their roles, and what they've been working on with us. And that's powerful because those roles are typically only assigned to male officers.
Vanessa, thanks for sharing those successes. It's tremendous to hear about 35 women. And of course, it's great to hear that the program has started to transform the culture. So outstanding work. We need the representation. All it takes is that trailblazer, right? That first woman to take that step and then the rest follow. You're doing something similar in Kenya, or is it a complete different effort?
It's similar in some ways, but it also is a very distinct project, bilateral as well. And through the work in Kenya, right, we are seeking to equip women to ultimately contribute more meaningfully to law enforcement and to the counterterrorism mission. Now, the way we're working in Kenya is by actually engaging with diverse units within their Kenya Police Service. One of them is the all-female SWAT team, which is really important to us because that was the unit that led to the inception or the birth of the Empower program. So in working with the Kenya Police Service, the Administration Police Service, and all different components of the National Police Service in Kenya, we've been able to train women not just on, let's say, softer skills like leadership development and professional development, but also focus more on the tactical and counterterrorism skills that women are often not afforded opportunities to engage with. We have really good partners out in Kenya that are willing to partner and join with us to actually put together these tactical courses, whether they're on tactical medicine so that women can actually deploy to the border and be of help, an opportunity that is currently limited for males in Kenya, but that we're opening roads and avenues to more women to actually be involved with, or developing the capacity of through marksmanship courses, for example, via which we train women on how to properly discharge a firearm, right? Which is super important when they're carrying one as part of their duties. So the program is a bit different in that sense, but I think, you know, the overall essence of both bilateral projects is very similar, is how do we actually help these women advance and fill the gaps that are currently preventing them from being more operational or contributing more meaningfully to that mission.
Thank you. Yeah, close that gap. And of course, you know, you never think about this, but yes, all this tactical training is imperative for law enforcement. Whether you live in a region that you might not see so much crime, I've never had to discharge my weapon in 13 years, but I had the training. I had the constant training that I had to go shoot. And it's just imperative for all of these ladies to be able to have access to great training, to save their lives, to save others' lives. And like you're saying, even the medical, right? Have the medical kit, have the right equipment. And that's the kind of things that Empower brings. Like you mentioned, resources in leadership classes, could be virtual classes. You know, Lynn mentioned mentorship. So Empower is just like this holistic type of training that you guys provide. It's not just to become leaders, but be able to work on the field as well. So it's just amazing work that you all do. How will you describe how you feel about your work with EasyTap?
Oh boy. You know, this is an easy one, but I have just like kind of like this flurry of words to describe how I feel about the work that we do together. I think two of them that stand out to me are just, it's rewarding. The job we do is very rewarding and it's fun, right? I actually really enjoy being able to engage with partners around the world, pursuing this collective mission of advancing women, right? It's fascinating to me and it's super interesting that we get to kind of roll our sleeves and work with the partners together to identify ways in which we can actually get where we want to get with them. And quite frankly, what drives me the most is just, there's this sort of sense of, you know, the need to remove these barriers that have kept women kind of constrained or limited for many years in many different types of environments, not just in the security sector or law enforcement, but all across. So I think this kind of collaborative learning approach, by which we, you know, are learning from the partners or learning from us, is keeps it entertaining, keeps it engaging, and just really fun. And on the other hand, I think I have an amazing team, like I said before, and it makes my life so much easier, but also so much more rewarding and interesting.
Thanks, Vanessa. Is there anything that I forgot to ask that you would like to mention? Any alibis?
I do want to give a shout out to all our partners across the globe that help us achieve our mission, right? Whether it's other offices and agencies within the United States government, or it's civil society organizations or NGOs that we partner with in one way or another. Our reach is limited, being that we're based in DC. So without them, really what we can do is also very limited. So shout out to them for helping push the mission forward and for rolling their sleeves with us and being willing to engage.
Of course. Thanks, Vanessa. Yes, you mentioned throughout, collaboration is key.
You just heard from Lynn Holland and from Vanessa Duboulay, who are amazing women supporting ECTAP Empower. As you heard, Lynn has over 33 years of law enforcement experience domestically and overseas. She is a trailblazer, one truly badass woman who has done so much for our country and so much for countries like Kosovo. And you heard from Vanessa, who is making waves in Jordan and Kenya. She is a program officer with ECTAP, working on their Global Programs in Women, Peace and Security Unit. And she focuses on ensuring women are equipped to combat terrorism. And by that, I mean from leadership classes all the way to having the right weapons and tactical gear needed to succeed in that environment. These two women, plus Grace Mason and Ivana Brennan, who you've heard in part one of this episode, are truly a tremendous force behind Empower. Tune in next week to hear our last segment of this three-part episode. To learn more about these extraordinary ladies, visit my website, badassinheels.com. Please share my episodes. By sharing, you are highlighting, you're educating, you're entertaining, and you're hopefully inspiring other women. Thanks again for your support. Bye.